very inviting me. It's tremendous to be in Cork somewhere I don't remember well at all. And all you, it's such fun, the five words, and it's great. Now, there's I have two names. I've been introduced as Nicola Griffin, which I used to write. All right, when I first moved to Ireland, I started doing things like, I'd ring the doctor and I'd say, I'd like an appointment, what's the name, Nicky Griffin, how old is he? It's me, it's not the boy or anything else. So Nicky seemed to be a boy's name, so I decided I was going to reclaim my childhood name of Nicola, which I did. And in Ireland, it's pronounced, it sounds much nicer than it did in England. It used to be Nicola, which is horrible ways. Like, Nicola, it sounds really nice, but I'll be Nicola again. So my poetry was, so in a lot of I was getting published as that. But the Inner Waterways News is a magazine of the Inner Waterways Association. Now, Joe, the husband, and I, we have a boat on the Shannon. It's a beautiful timber cruiser, our beloved boat, which we spend a lot of time on. And I wrote this book, The Skipper and Her Mate. I'm the skipper, and he's the mate, about our time. And that was under the name of Nicky Griffin, because that's what I wrote under in the Inner Waterways News. So when the poetry came out, it was then I was talking to Jesse Lendenny of Salmon Poetry, saying, am I going to be Nicola or Nicky? So it was decided I will be Nicky, because that's what I was on the other side. This is Nicky now. So so that's why the difference in the names. So this collection, it's called On Belonging, really, because any of you who are not from the place where you now live will probably be familiar with that feeling of not quite belonging anywhere. And I was brought up in Cheshire, which is a very rural county. I'd always been there. The land around was very important to me. I felt very much at home there and didn't have to think about it. And then when we moved to Clare, I absolutely loved it, but of course I was an outsider. And that feeling of being an outsider has directed quite a bit of my poetry. Other theme in this book would be also, I suppose, would be things about, there's a poem called Security, for example. It's about the feeling of always being watched, of the big brotherishness of our lives these days will be something that obsesses me a little bit. So, I'm going to start with a poem. It's called Learning Irish. Because one of the things I wanted to... I hate not being able to pronounce words. Absolutely can't bear it. And so I thought, if I at least learn some Irish so I can pronounce words. And I did an online course. Actually, so it was Munster Irish that I was learning, because it was in a Cork-based online thing. So, which is no use whatsoever in Clare, because everybody around there speaks Connemara Irish. Anyway. You're pronouncing that wrong. No, I'm not. Right, so this is Learning Irish. The first lesson is a garble of incomprehension. Sounds misbehave in my mouth, tongue rebelling against too many vowels. Dear good, I falter, hello in Irish. Or rather, God be with you, the terrain being different as Gwelia. I learn to talk about the weather, relishing sounds so foreign to an English speaker's ears. Toshé, clobinach boshdi, becomes a particular favourite. As my tongue discovers this new way to speak, a hidden landscape declares itself. I'm going to read some poems as well that aren't in the book. I'm going to read this one because this is from my pre-life. It's a sort of crossover poem of how I was and how I am. It's called Hair Suit. In the 80s, refusing to shave was our feminist duty. Hairy armpits, a political act of liberation from potions and baby pink razors sold by the capitalist patriarchy. We recognise the sisters of struggle by softly furred legs worn with pride. Abhorred the need for bikini line neatness, though secretly some on beach bound days applied the IMAC. When I moved to a place where underarm hair signalled crusty or hippie or blow-in outsider, I trousered my overgrown legs and avoided the strappy, the sleeveless, the vest. Until that sticky day in June, when it all came off, mass depilation, freedom to hang out, or cowardly sell out.
Thank you.
this poem is called On Belonging. It's the name of the book, as you will have noticed. I'm a passionate gardener. I always have been, and my garden is over an acre, and I spend probably more time in it than the husband approves of, but he does get to eat nice vegetables and look at beautiful flowers, and we have a lot of birds and wildlife. So this is On Belonging. The black bamboo I planted thrashes in the wind as though trying to rip itself out, return to its native subtropical China, or get warm in this cold country. But it's not easy to dislodge now, roots deep beside my pond. They're not invasive, not spreading, unwanted as others have, acting with discretion as an outsider must when seeking to assimilate. I try to root myself as tightly as the bamboo, but it's difficult to get a grip in a place where family history defines who you are. Thrashing about, afraid to speak, a foreigner without the forgiveness of exotic. Silently I create my garden in the hungry earth where the rules of growth remain unchanged. Chaffinches sing the same songs, trees spring the same leaves. And finally, after 13 years, I find my voice in the patterns of a poem, except On Belonging. This one's called Whistleblower. You might know what it's about. This time the sparrowhawk's aim is good, or the goldfinch too brave, alone at the feeder, taking no heed of warning calls. Scarlet and black bullseye face, drawing the hawk to snatch with purpose-built claws. Any lonely finch that dares poke its head above the parapet to unsecret a hawk's cache of confidentials becomes the target for reptilian claws that prey upon the powerless, snatch and tear them bone from bone. Now, see what you think about this one. It's called Tart Desires. Last Friday, as we travelled to work, he said he wanted wife in the kitchen, whore in his bed. It seemed I didn't fulfil his idea of the latter. On Saturday, after the Tesco run, I slipped round the corner to a place I had seen where they sold a selection of toys, not for children. That night, I got frisky and led him to bed, revealed the suspenders and brandished the cuffs. Flipped to the bedpost, his wife whore astride, he cried out in passion and shock. Was that whore like enough? I said, sliding away. My God, it was, he replied. I regarded his sorry state of depletion and dangled the keys to his freedom. Then you'll give me my fee of €500. No way, he said. I showed him the checkbook. But a payment is due to release you from clamping, I said, and I walked out the door. So, some of you may remember the times before we had bright lights everywhere and everything was on show and we were being watched and so on. And this is, I remember those times well. Security. Before they changed the street lights to orange, bedrooms were dark enough for ghosts to mumble between floorboards, hungering for the toes of children. On no moon nights, shadows slid along alleyway walls, while an ear strained away on the path behind, footsteps tapped, stars the only witness. Before they changed the streetlights to orange, there were no mechanical eyes clicking round the town square to spy on the carnal abandon of teenagers. Now city night skies burn vermilion around the guttering moon, and all you can see through the trespassing glare is a pinpoint shiny satellite watching you. an awful lot of time on the river. We've been right up to. I don't know if any of you. You're an outland waterways place here, of course. So you probably have nothing to do with the inland waterways. But there's a huge network. So I live quite near to the Shannon. So we've got all the way Shannon from Limerick. You go right the way up. You can then join the Shannon Urn Waterway at Leitrim Village and go into Loch Urn, which is tremendous, highly recommended. You can go as far as Baleek, which is just into Donegal. And you can go along the Grand Canal and then turn right, end up in Waterford, or you can go to Dublin, and the Royal Canal. But I don't write many poems, really, about the river. I don't know why that is. I think it's because when you get on a boat, you have all the books with you, you bring loads of stuff, and you sit there, and gradually, as time goes by, and you pull into a harbour, and you sit there, and oh, there's a boat coming in. Oh, yeah. There's another boat coming in. Oh, yeah. As you can gather, it's very relaxing on the waterway. There's one here. It is really about a waterway thing. It's called Crossing Places. At the crossing places, when the river is still and ghosts untangle themselves from the trees, you can feel their hunger for the living. My reflection stares up from where rocks lie heavy and mud is thick with longing. Stepping stones pile one on another, invisible now to all but those who search among the river sludge that marks so carelessly layer on layer of human passing. And there, beside the laden bridge, a child is skimming stones, everything in the world still to know. I have no idea how much time I have here.
You're fine.
I didn't notice what time I started or anything. Now, this next poem is called After Answering an Advert to Join a Commune. It wasn't me. These poems. Some of my poems are a little bit autobiographical, but mostly they're not. This one isn't autobiographical as such, but it was based on a story, because the husband actually did used to live in a commune many years ago in Cornwall, which is where we're going on holiday after. Today we're in a camper van and we're getting the ferry and going to Cornwall. So, and it's also, I don't know if any, you know when you come across somebody who has that real charisma and they try and convince you they know everything and they tell you what you should be doing and you're sort of guru, that's what I do. So after answering an advert to join a commune. One. On the slick of rain-drenched motorway where hitchhikers wait, the old van stops, takes me in. I am drowning. We drive for hours into the southwest, then, abandoned by the day, follow dim headlights down narrowing lanes. Ahead, the house is unlit but for one small window, float in the dark. The kitchen smells of distant cinnamon, toast, of things I can't identify. He heats up soup on the still hot range, which we eat with hunks of homemade bread at the pockmarked wooden table. In the morning, he says, he will bring me to the man who changes lives. Two. I am flying high on the hill after making the call I was told to make. Separation, the only way to free a mind from suburbia, they said. I watch the distant line of washed blue that sends its seaweed tang inland on the southern breeze. I am looking for a sign. On the phone, my mother cried. They said she would. But afterwards they surround me in hugs. Low voices soothe self-inflicted wound as my mother's incomprehension cuts into my mind, already creating its livid scar. Three. Escaping from the kitchen fog, I walk along the forest edge. Midwinter, just after four, and I'm enveloped in shadowy dusk. When I turn off the torch, the small dog is a smudge of white ahead. The black dog invisible until the eyes adjust in a clarity of steady revelation. A road, grass strip up the middle, pale barked ghost trees, thousands of stars in the uplifted curve above. Of half-truths and untruths pronounced as prophecy by the man who changes lives. Walking up the hill to the house, I see clouds shift to reveal the moon dawn. my eyes open to the light. 4. The house is dark, but for one small window afloat in the black. I turn off the light as I leave, shrug the rucksack onto my shoulder, carry my boots. At the end of the drive, I stop to look back. A smudge of white dog watches. Warm night air beguiles with musky odours of home. A star shoots across the wane of the moon. I make my wish, step onto the high banked road. So this is another voting one. Now this, if you like, it connects your type of waterway, my type of waterway, because what happened during those magnificent boom years, when everybody had loads of money just sloshing around, was that it became the thing to have a massive cruiser on Loch Derg, which is where I live near. It didn't do to have one with just one engine. You had to have two engines, which is your offshore type of boat, and it had to be like a big broom, huge thing, and the propellers on one of those boats stick out like this. No, it's meant for the sea, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course, so they were forever getting damaged, which cost about 45 grand a time. Ah, money. And you had to be a member of the RNLI, not the inland waterways on, but the offshore had to be. So these guys, this is about these guys. Okay. Cruiser. When the boat pulls into Vicaro Harbour, shadows fall on smaller craft. The skipper, high on his flybridge, bow thrusts his way to the quay wall. Firm above him rises the mast for VHF, although he's never out of range with his mobile phone. The overhead arch wears a dish for radar and radar reflector in case he should meet a ship on Loch Reef. A Garmin GPS chart plotter flickers to guide him along the banks of the Shannon. Today he has come all the way from his berth at the south of the lake, an hour away if he takes it easy, which he doesn't. He disembarks with his crew, tip-top in full musto sailing gear for stepping ashore on rainy days. Later, after the poop deck party, he starts up the jenny for watching the telly. He's an offshore member of the RNLI, although he never goes to sea, and only last week spent 50 grand having snagged a rock in Black Brink Bay with a starboard propeller designed to propel in the ocean. So he tries to go slow when leaving Licaro, along the shallow, narrow canal, but his boat, like those of developer friends, is built for speed, for going to France, for zipping from Cork to Dublin Bay, and bad though I am to gloat and mock, I'm glad to see these mortgage monsters for sale, for sale, for sale. I don't have a problem at all with people who love boating, but you just had an awful lot of people at that time, so just complete status, simple, and nothing else. Okay, so. This is called What I Would Tell My Child If I Had One. That the ash will regrow from its chainsawed stump, and a spider will bite when cornered. Middle age does not mean becoming your mother, necessarily. Friendships can fail over soured milk. Two small shoes will not stretch to fit. A garden forgives every year. An open coffin holds no fear. The wind from the west exhilarates, while the wind from the east brings scents of spices. The chance is all we have. Now, as a gardener, I'm an organic gardener, which I don't know, it's a bit pedantic maybe, but I always have been. To be honest, it's as much because I have a great love of the wildlife as anything else, and so I save quite a lot of my own seeds as well, and I know the importance of it. So this is I suppose an anti-Monsanto rant. You know that might be enough. Keep saving. Such a tiny thing to make a fuss about. A seed, a grain he can pinch between finger and thumb, hide in the crease of his palm. Buried in his plot of land, its germ becomes two leaves pushing to the light, planted in rows, each a replication becoming itself. Landrace plants, adapted to place, unowned, passed down, given, food for the table, seeds for gathering, shaken from last year's crop. But corporations have other ideas. Claim copyright on his means to life in a race to profit, to maximise, to sell back what's already his. Sell back what's already ours, renting the right to patented seeds. Such a tiny thing to fuss about. Our future in the crease of our palms. Is another passion of mine. This one's called Women Work. Knitting myself into this coat, the yarn passed down through generations of grandmothers, I see strangers from the maternal side whose judgment clicks along inside the needles as I knit and purl my stitched skin of wool. My mother has given me the brightest yarn in a skein of love that I knit into the length of my coat on shiny tipped needles, used by her mother to swaddle children, grandchildren and dolls in stocking stitched cardigans, hats and scarves. The weight of wool sits curled on my lap, purring with the rhythm of fingers that blur into ancestral fingers knitting. I'll just do a couple more. You know, probably the men will think, oh, that's one for women. Some parts of the world, though, men knit as well. I don't know if any of you have ever been to the Yorkshire Dales, but there's, it's, I forget which dale it was, but all the buttermilk used to be blue because everything's kept in lead-lined containers. So they're all off their heads because of the lead. And so the shepherds used to have a belt. This is all in a real, was it Wensleydale?
Swaledale.
The shepherds would have a belt on which was a knitting needle, one fixed needle, and they were hyperactive because of all the lead, of course. And so the whole time they were shepherding, they'd be knitting away. So, some men, you see, can knit too. Let's see now. Oh, yes, this is a nasty little one. The quiver. Aspen leaves quiver at the touch of the wind, each one showing an alternate face to the light, twisting as though to escape their final fate. My lover quivers at the touch of my hand, caressing the length of her silken back, circling her golden throat gently, gently. My wife quivers at the touch of my tongue, sharpening itself. She stands at the table, sharpening knives to escape the final truth. One small one. Let's see. How do this one? Samhain. It's the wrong time of year, I know. But we do have bonfires. We live in a very remote place, big garden. There's always lots of things to burn at that time of year. It's really nice to do it. Samhain, and it's around my birthday as well. And there's no midges at that time of year, which is always a bonus. Have you had midges here?
Yes.
Midges?
No,
we actually have a midge eating machine, which is terrific. Oh. Developed on the west of Scotland, it's like a box. And you need one gas bottle, it has a little bag in it, and you have this thing, a lure, which apparently smells of humans or something. And that attracts the midges from. You can get different sized ones, so ours attracts the midges from a quarter of an acre. And the gas bottle runs this little fan that draws them into this bag, and they can't get out again. And it works. You have to keep it going the whole time because they reproduce something like 2 million a day.
My goodness.
They really do reproduce, but it works. It means that you can actually go out in the garden and survive. they die within 24 hours anyway, so you just it's not that idea, you take them out and put, no, what you do is you take the midge bag to somebody you don't like. You mix them and
they're good on the barbecue.
Yeah. You need lots of them to get any sort of flavour. So that was Samhain without. Samhain without midges. At the hinge of the year, she stands on the edge of darkness. Trees whisper their secrets down the long valley to the sea, while flames whisper uncertainty around damp wood. The overnight hatching of mushrooms, conker-coloured, glutinous, squashes underfoot, releasing a murmur of slaughterhouse stench, messengers from the underworld. Inside the bonfire's bright circle, ghosts drift through spark-filled smoke. Darkness enshrouds, penetrates her with its annual threat to unhinge. She casts her usual spell in hope against the long nights to come. Next day it rains, all souls washed out. Jack-o'-lantern mocks from the courtyard. Across the lawn, candle holders sway and shudder in the wind. I suppose that's one for any of us who suffer any of the seasonal affective disorder in the winter depression or longer. This is one for you. I'll finish on this. One for you when you wake up at 3 a.m. in the morning. It's called 3 a.m. Winter, and I am awake again in the darkness of a moonless night. No light to drive out the black animal that creeps about my head, tonguing its way around hidden hurts like an evil mother, licking to life the morbid thoughts of 3 a.m.